From the Firebird Radio Studio, it's the Authors on Fire podcast with nationally syndicated radio host and producer, Pat Rulo.
Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network, home of the Firebird Book Awards, the Positive Change Podcast Awards Hall of Fame, our newest book song, where we create a unique one-of-a-kind song just for your book, and this podcast, Authors on Fire. I am Pat Rulo. Today, I have a special and a returning author to share with you, Beth S.K. Morris, last quarter's winner in the categories of memoir and poetry for the book titled A Yellowed Notebook. Beth joins us to discuss her book, a hybrid memoir that blends her poetry with her late father's handwritten reflections. This intimate collection explores love, memory, loss, and legacy, creating a tender dialogue across generations. And I know this will be a moving conversation for anyone who cherishes family and storytelling and the healing power of words. Welcome back to the Authors on Fire podcast, Beth.
So glad to be here with you again, Pat. It's a joy and an honor.
I feel the same way about you. Yes, we spoke about your book about 9/11 in the aftermath the last time we spoke, and now we've got this book that you wrote with your dad, I'm going to say. So congratulations on winning both. These are two important categories, memoir and poetry. Those are big ones. So congratulations on winning the Firebird for those.
Well, it was such an incredible surprise and honor to win in both categories. And who would have thunk it?
Well, I think when you have a book such as this from the heart, I think people recognize that. Yep.
Yes. Thank you.
Yes. So A Yellowed Notebook, A Daughter, A Father, and A Dialogue Across Time. Beth, take us back to the moment you first rediscovered your father's notebook. What did you feel when you opened those pages after so many years?
Well, this is quite a long journey. My father died in 1977, this time of year, on December 19th. And it was following a 10-year battle with chronic heart disease that debilitated him over those period of 10 years into his early retirement. And my parents were living in Florida at the time. My mother moved back to New York and boxed up a whole bunch of stuff that I just put in a box someplace in a storage room. When I returned to New York about 10 years ago, after living in Florida myself, I found this book and I said, "What is in here? I have no idea." And I opened it up, and sure enough, there was my father's notebook along with some other memorabilia from the early years, photographs and such. And I opened it up and I said, gee, I have to write a book based on this. So I ventured into what's kind of like a unique, strange area. Most people who do collaborative poetry work do it with a live author. You know, they share parts of poems or one poem after the other. And this is a collaboration with someone who's already gone for, you know, more than almost 50 years. So in some places you see a combination of his words, his exact words, and a poem that was drawn from it. And one of my readers said it reminded her very much of Natalie Cole's duet mix with her dad. With Nat King Cole, and it runs like that. And the structure of it is very much musical. It's based on the rondo format. Those of you who are familiar with musical terms, it's in three parts. The first, family; the second part, his work; and the third part, his retirement and diminishment. And his words from the book are woven in between in each of the three areas. So that's how it happened.
I love how this is all very musical, actually, because being a hybrid work, it's rather a poetic duet between you and your father. And then to put it in a three-part rondo structure also adds that musical framework to it. And then that person who compared it to Unforgettable with Natalie Cole singing alongside her father, I don't know, it's almost beyond words.
Yes, and it's so funny because Nat King Cole was so much a part of my growing up in the 50s, mm-hmm. in my childhood in the 50s. I'm signaling my age, but, you know, that's it.
No, I get
but,
that.
Nat King Cole was a classic in my life, all his music. Yep. And so when she said that, maybe in the back of my subconscious, I had that duet in mind. And I saw her perform that live on stage before Natalie Cole retired. So it means a lot to me, that comparison.
Oh, I get that. And I feel that. You feel that with this book. That's why I'm saying whoever figured that out was actually spot on. What did you learn about your father, if anything, maybe emotionally, spiritually, or personally, while reading his handwritten reflections from his final months?
One thing I did learn, I knew, of course, he was the chairman of the fur department at the High School of Fashion Industries in New York City, which is a landmark historic place. It was built in the 1930s and early 40s, and a magnificent architectural building. And he was also at the same time an archaeologist. And I found out from this notebook that he was instrumental in the forming the Endangered Species Act in the United States to prevent people from killing and using furs from endangered animals and importing them into the United States. And a lot of the articles he wrote before he passed away were sent to various journals to reinforce the Endangered Species Act. And very much involved in the environment before Al Gore, before all the other movements in the 1960s. So, and some of the poems and the words are in the book itself towards the end, and I'm going to read one or two of them for you.
Please do.
In the interest. So if you want me to start with a poem or two, just to give
yes.
everybody a flavor.
Yeah. Yes, please.
So since I mentioned to you and everyone that it's in form of a rondo, let me start with the family part of the rondo, the beginning, with the first two poems, which are kind of short. The book ends and begins with haiku. Mm. So this is December 1951. Snow drifts rise on shore. Our skates skim the frozen lake. Father, my sentry. And here's the poem that follows, The Blizzard. No street lights, no lamps lit in the houses on Ocean Avenue. Just my father and me, headed for King's Highway in search of milk, bread, anything we can find, threading our way through walls of ice and snow. I sit cross-legged, arms folded across my chest, just as my father instructed, a rope around my waist, tied to the back of the sled to keep me from falling off. My job, hold tight to the bags on the way home. I don't know how my father carried me, the sled, across the street to the trolley stop, how he followed the tracks under the snow, in the dark. All I can see is the back of his coat, his arms and hands stretched out behind him, pulling the ropes, dragging the sled, the steady crunch of his boots.
Oh my gosh. That is so impactful, and it really reveals the enduring impact fathers have on their daughters.
Yes.
Oh, stunning.
And it starts off with a tremendous physical strength he had, and he was an athlete too, among other things. He was really a Renaissance man in many ways. He did his own, you know, he was from the generation that went through the Depression and learned how to do everything themselves. any kind of electrical work or problems around the house. We couldn't afford to hire people to come in. And they learned how to do everything themselves. It's the same thing on the women's side. My mother knitted, my mother sewed, my mother crocheted, my mother, I still have some of her work, her artistic work. And this is a generation that knew how to do all of this because they had to, in order to preserve money.
Beth, when you wrote your poems, were they shaped directly in response to his entries, or did you allow them to emerge organically? How did that work?
They rose from a lot of his entries, a lot of his entries, and they also arose around those entries, having to do with my memories of my childhood. And it's not only since it's family that begins it; it's not just my dad. I have memories that have to do with his family, particularly his father. So here's a poem that talks about my grandpa Joe, my grandpa Joseph. And it comes because in his notebook, he did a genealogy of his parents. And back before Ancestry.com came along, he wrote a whole timeline, going back like two, three generations. So here's a poem that directly comes out of an entry from the notebook. It begins with his description of his father, my grandfather. This is from my dad's notebook. Kaplan, and in parentheses, the word Bromberg. Joseph, he was a farrier in Russia, born in Kishinev, Bessarabia, which is now Moldova, by the way. The family name was changed to evade conscription in the Tsarist army. Joe, my pop. He was an important Menshevik revolutionary, exiled to Siberia, sent 2,000 miles on horseback, released in 1905 amnesty, came to Chicago in 1907, 1908 to meet my mother. I was born in a tenement over Comiskey Park. Baseball, and my father instilled in me a love of baseball that I still have to this day. Oh my goodness, was he a ball fan. Chicago Cubbies. If anyone in our family ever visits the USSR records, they have his name. The USSR keeps very good records of their pioneer revolutionaries. From Dave's Notebook, 1977. And here's the poem. After Siberia. Grandpa carried his samovar into the dining room, set it on a stand in front of his chair at the head of the table. A heavy silver urn, 2 feet high, engraved with vines and flowers, a pattern common in Bessarabia. No coffee or tea in the cylinder, no bowl or cup to catch the flow of boiling water. A simple plate, thin slices of lemon in the center. I sat in silence next to him. Just before he released the valve, he placed a lump of sugar on his tongue and lifted the saucer of seething nectar to his mouth. Let me take you into his work. As I said, he was a chairman of the fur department at the High School of Fashion Industries. And after the war, the fur business, particularly that one that was centered in New York in what they called the Fur District, it was a huge business and an enormous part of the garment industry. And in the midst of it was the High School of Fashion Industries. And my father would take me there on special occasions, and it was like going into another world. It was so beautiful. In the auditorium, there is a Depression area, post-Depression mural, 17 feet high, and each one of the panels covers all of the auditorium walls. from one side to the other, including, of course, the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, which is a big part of American history and the labor movement. Those of you who don't know, and younger people would not know, the sweatshops in New York City were predominantly staffed by immigrant girls, Jewish, Italian, Irish, some of them like 12, 14, 16 years old. And they had no ventilation. They were locked in so that they could not go out until the owners of the building sweatshops would let them out. And there was a fire there, and they could not get out except to jump out of the windows. And it's sometime in March. Unfortunately, I've forgotten the date when we honor this. And there is a plaque in the Triangle Building in Lower Manhattan that honors this event. So here's a poem that's called The Mural. He pushed open the wooden doors to the auditorium at the high school where he taught. Lining the walls on either side, Depression-era murals, each fresco 17 feet high and 65 feet wide. My father explained the first painting as we walked forward, stepped slowly past Victory of Light Over Darkness, immigrant life on the Lower East Side, sweatshops, child labor, tenements. I didn't pay much attention until my eyes fixed on the last panel closest to the stage, the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. I leaned back against the seat behind me, stretched my neck, lifted my face to take in the scene. Purple smoke billowing from the factory, workers jumping out of windows, women crying and mourning over the dead bodies lying on the street, the girls not much older than me. But the colors, pastels, like the chalk set I'd gotten for my birthday, green, yellow, pink, and blue, blue, blue. And here's the follow-up. Victory of light over darkness. Even now, when I have to settle for a 2-inch reproduction on the internet, I see the dead woman lying on the ground, eyes shut, mouth agape, body twisted by her fall. Yet she's draped in a bright yellow skirt, geometrically arranged across her torso, a mourner leaning over her, sobbing into her hands, wrapped in regal purple, sculpted like the ancient statues of Athena. No matter how often I see Victory of Light Over Darkness, I find comfort in the artist's power to render the unbearable bearable.
Wow. What was the timing of your writing this book and in the aftermath?
The timing is only 4 years later, but when I finished the book, I knew I had to get this, you know, I've always had this notebook sitting next to me, you know, in my desk area, my little office area. And I said, now is the time to do it. And unfortunately, a lot of it was triggered by my sister's death, a premature death after surgery. I said, I better get this history down before I, you know, I lose track of it myself. So that's what promulgated it. I really felt empowered and very much like I did about the book about 9/11, yeah. You know, but that was on the 20th anniversary of 9/11, you know, so I didn't want 20 years to go by, obviously.
Right.
Before I decided to pay attention to all of this.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep. It presented itself to you for a reason.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, let's take us back to the retirement area.
Yes.
Let me read one of the poems that is exactly from his words adapted into a poem. And you're going to find this very strange. This was written in 1977, and he talked about the North American gray wolf. It's very interesting. I watched a nature show last night about the gray wolf in Canada. And it's in this, and this is 2025, and we're still facing the same problem with the disappearance of these endangered species. And this is adapted out of his words. And he was sending this to England to a nature magazine. The North American gray wolf. The future of the wolf is still in doubt, a subject of much interest to conservationists. Just a few grays left in Minnesota, the timber wolf subspecies. Let me interrupt and tell you this is in the form of a pantoum, which repeats certain lines in the next stanza. A subject of much interest in conservationists. Alaska's herd, 100,000. In Minnesota, the timber wolf subspecies. Canada still has a few. Alaska's herd, 100,000. The red wolf is almost extinct. Canada still has a few. All wolves in the lower 48 endangered. The red wolf is almost extinct. Some of the specimens have been tagged, radio collared. All wolves in the lower 48 endangered. A 15-year study is still in progress. Some of the specimens have been tagged, radio collared. Just a few grays left. A 15-year study is still in progress, but the future of the wolf is still in doubt. Think about this is 1977, and we've been getting warnings about the environment and the ecology starting in the 1960s, and we still haven't paid attention. It's still going on our merry way, as if we're going to live on this planet forever, right?
So your father was a furrier, so he made his living
Yes.
this way, and what swayed
He
him
was a,
to ch change his
he never changed his mind.
okay.
He always was very much involved in ecology. In most of the first, he was a mink cutter, and they were very specialized people. And the minks that they dealt with were farmed, and not predominantly for furs. They were farmed for their food in dog food, and they still are in dog food. The minks that are farmed, they are farmed for the oils. The mink oil is used as an oil for saddles and for baseball mitts. Every part of the mink body is used, and the fur is from the minks is used for to be able to create designs out of it. My father was an incredible designer of different kinds of coats. And two of his students became very famous furriers in the night, right through the 1980s and 90s. It was Antonovich Furs that advertised all over the country, and he kind of put them in business. They were two of his students after the Korean War when he taught the veterans. They were never in favor of it. Of course, you've got the rest of the world. You have China and Russia still making fur coats and killing endangered species, you know, like the foxes and the lynx and all the other things that are now endangered in the United States. So he only dealt with that at the time, and he wrote a couple of books about the history of the fur business. Very important books in the industry. And he was very much a part of Women's Wear Daily, which is the, he did articles for Women's Wear Daily, which is the fashion magazine in New York. One had nothing, really had nothing to do with the other. So the last two poems in the book, and this is adapted from his notebook in the form of a sonnet. And just listen, think about this from 1977 to today. An historical flashback. Adapted from Dave's Notebook, 1977. As early as 1930, a special Senate committee on conservation of wildlife resources came to this conclusion. The primary threat to wildlife was the loss of habitat, due in part to drainage, deforestation, fire, disease, water pollution, and the extended occupation of land by agriculture and industry. All subsequent studies have reinforced the original analysis by this committee, which applies today not only to the U.S., but the rest of this fragile earth. And here's the last poem. December 2021. Matchbook box cover closed. Candle of remembrance burns. Through my window, snow.
Just beautiful. You should be so proud of this. Yeah, I'm wondering if your father could read this finished book. Well, I wonder what he would feel or understand.
I think he would like it very much.
Oh my gosh. For sure.
But he would tell me, always the critic, he would tell me, if I came back with a grade that was like 98, he would ask me where the other 2 points were. A very, very high standards of living and moral values and everything else.
Yes.
Yeah. The one thing I do regret is that my kids never really had a chance to have him. My nephews, yes. He was still well enough to be able to, you know, to be with them and to teach them how to build things and how to plant things and how to do creative kinds of works. He would have been right in there inventing video games, you know. And he was also a fantastic chess player, and he was a blackjack player. He did a lot of stuff. He did a lot of stuff.
What an important man and inspiring. I'm so happy that you were able to capture this and share it and put it out there, because I also imagine it's going to help other people perhaps deal and process with their own loss or grief, just to see how you handled it. I'm wondering, are there any other future works, perhaps with more hybrid or memoir poetic pieces, or was this?
Well, two things. One, the 25th anniversary is coming up of 9/11.
Yes.
What I've decided to do is to add a supplement to In the Aftermath, 9/11 Through a Volunteer's Eyes, a supplement which will add to and bring us up to the 25th anniversary in September 2026, of course. And it's going to include additional poems that bring us up to date. Particularly, I'm concerned with the fact that the continuing deaths of the recovery workers and people who lived in the downtown area from the toxic effects of Ground Zero.
Absolutely.
25 years later, they are still passing from all the now hundreds, close to hundreds of diseases that developed from the toxins at Ground Zero.
Sure.
And so I'm going to be dedicating the book, the reprint of the book, to the 25th anniversary as well.
Oh, excellent. I look forward to that. And yes, how devastating. People think the event happened, it's over, but the people who were living there, the health ramifications were just so huge and probably forgotten by most people. No, not many
yes.
people think about that. So, well, how timely for you to kind of reiterate that and bring that back to the forefront. Very, very important.
Yes, I feel a responsibility for that, you know, since I was a volunteer down there and saw a lot. And so I feel a personal responsibility to be able to extend that and make sure that 9/11 is not just a bumper sticker.
Exactly, exactly. It's real people and real ramifications still reverberating through the community. So your work is powerful, my friend, completely powerful. Just you are powerful, just like your father, obviously, and your mother, from what it sounds like. You come from some really strong people. I want to make sure as we begin to close that we're not missing anything that you wanted to highlight about this book. Anything?
Nothing except that it is available on Amazon. And I believe did you have the posting for it on Amazon? It's both available in ebook as well as the paper book. So you can get it from Amazon. And if you contact me at BethSabard@AOL.com via email, I'll be more than happy to send you a signed copy. Okay. But the website is www.BethSabard.info. And that will also give you the information how to contact me should you want signed copies of either one of those, by the way.
Right.
Of In the Aftermath or A Yellow Notebook.
All righty. We are speaking with Beth S.K. Morris, and the book is titled A Yellow Notebook, which is clearly more than a book. It's a bridge across generations, a celebration of memory, and a testament to the enduring power of voice. So, Beth, I want to thank you for sharing your story, your art, and your heart, and your father. And to our listeners, I hope that you can carry your own memories, your own voices, and the words of those you love gently forward. Beth, you're a gift. Thank you for sharing your books with us at Firebird Book Awards, and thank you for joining me today on Authors on Fire. I so appreciate you.
I'm honored, Pat, with your words. Thank you.